What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, concerns as Pacific countries lose skilled health workers to Australia's labour mobility scheme. Vanuatu marks 1 year since a deadly earthquake destroyed parts of the capital, Port Vila. And it's been a horror week on the roads as PNG workers die in accidents. We'll have more on those stories coming up. You're listening to Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. We start in Tonga, where a new prime minister was elected into office earlier this week. 40-year-old Lord Fakafanua defeated his rivals by 16 votes to 10 to become the nation's new prime minister. It's not only his age that's been attracting attention, but Lord Fakafanua is just the second noble to be elected to the top job since democratic reforms were introduced in 2010. His appointment, as can be expected, has sparked concern about the state of Tonga's democratic system. But Lord Fakafanua told the ABC's Kyle Evans that such claims were scaremongering.
A key feature of the political reform in 2010 has been instability of the last 15 years with consistent votes of no confidences. We've had many changes of government, and I think that stability in the House will reflect stability in the nation if we can try and unify everyone. So there are many aspects to this. My next steps as Prime Minister, now that I've been appointed by His Majesty, is to appoint my cabinet. And part of the consideration is trying to consider some of the opposition, whether it's appropriate to have them inside my cabinet, because there's the aspect of loyalty versus unity. And sometimes might be better to have them as a strong opposition to keep us accountable. But these are some of the considerations I haven't really made my mind up on. But that is definitely the platform that I was advocating for leading up to the election on Monday. But it's still an ongoing discussion, something that I'm carefully considering before Christmas.
Now, in 2010, Tonga brought in democratic reforms that were meant to strengthen democratic representation and limit the power of the monarchy and nobility. You are a noble yourself. Tonga's crown prince is your brother-in-law, and you're a member of the royal family through your mother. How do you respond to concerns that, with you as prime minister, Tonga is sliding backwards with its democracy?
In terms of sliding backwards, there haven't been any legislative changes or constitutional amendments to warrant such scaremongering. In 2010, we went through major political reform where the 9 people's representatives were increased to 17. The nobles' representatives were 9 in total before the democratic reform, and they maintained the status quo afterwards. I believe that the reform that was intended by King George Debo V was implemented to give not only a greater voice to the people by increasing their representation from 9 to 17, but also give Parliament the authority to elect its Prime Minister from within the 26 members. And so it is the same democratic principle and same democratic constitution that we had in 2010 that we are now having in 2025.
As a member of the nobility, you know, I guess transparency is not always a characteristic of nobility, generally speaking, across the world. I guess, how will you navigate what is, I guess, an inherent conflict of interest there?
There is no inherent conflict of interest. In terms of transparency, we are still accountable to the same rules, to the same laws, to the same constitution that all members of parliament, regardless of if you're a member of the nobility or not. If you're a people's representative, you're still under the same rules that guide transparency and good governance and accountability. That question came up in debate on Monday when we were electing the Prime Minister, and I responded by saying that we are still accountable to the same constitution. And as long as we remain accountable to the constitution, we are accountable like everyone else.
Prime Minister, I want to talk about some of the issues you've raised in the lead up to becoming Prime Minister. The passport proposal to sell passports as part of a citizenship by investment scheme. Donga has tried selling passports before, a scheme that became deeply controversial and was eventually scrapped amid concerns about corruption, loss of trust and damage to Donga's international reputation. Given that history, where do you stand on it?
Look, I think that given the country's fiscal position, we've been running on a budget deficit and highly reliant on overseas donor support to prop up the government services. We have to be realistic about diversifying government's revenue and expanding our tax base, and we don't want to overburden the existing hardworking people of Tonga. And so we have to weigh every proposal on its merits. And at the moment, the current proposal that is being floated around, even though it was leaked from the previous government, it has its own merits. And I think if we process it through the appropriate channels, have it debated rigorously and put it through its vetting process, through public consultation and through Parliament, and if His Majesty approves it, then it might show some benefit to the country, given that we are about $1.4 billion in infrastructure deficit, and that would help create a more resilient country. It would put us in good stead to support government services that our people, and especially the poor, we can help lift them.
Just on those merits, how big is the financial benefit? Because Vanuatu, you know, they've learned the hard way how easily the scheme can be exploited by bad actors if not regulated properly. What are the benefits of such a scheme, and how do they outweigh the potential bad publicity that may come from it?
You know, from an initial standpoint, it seems like it far outweighs the risks. And I believe that given Tonga's bad history of passports in the past, the new proposal addresses and mitigates a lot of the risks in terms of money laundering and inviting the wrong type of people. And there are internal protections that exist today that didn't exist in the past. Now we have an Office of the Ombudsman, directly under the Parliament of Tonga. And now we have an anti-corruption commissioner that's been appointed, and that office is currently working to hold government and public service accountable. So there are certain mechanisms that we can introduce to help strengthen good governance and ensure that the money flows towards where it is appropriately required within government to support government services and also raise the standard of living for every Tongan.
And that's Tonga's new Prime Minister, Lord Whakawhanua, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Kyle Evans. The Pacific is facing a health crisis, with nurses and doctors jumping ship to join Australia's labour mobility scheme. A new report has found that an exodus of skilled health workers are heading here to Australia for better pay and work conditions, depriving some Pacific nations of up to 40% of their skilled workforce. The ABC's Lucy Cooper with more on this story.
It's a common theme in the Pacific: hospitals with outdated equipment and facilities struggling to cope with a growing population. But now there's a further problem. Pacific countries are losing skilled nurses to Australia. Fiona McDonald, the Director of Future Work at the Australia Institute, says some health services are on the brink of collapse.
We'd heard stories of dire circumstances where health workforces are in shortage in those countries, and also in a context of underfunded services that were really struggling. One of the reasons why those systems are struggling is because of the loss of experienced and skilled workers.
Their new report is based on consultations with Pacific workers, union representatives and the Australian government. It found an exodus of skilled nurses and doctors joining the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme.
You lose highly skilled workers to other countries because there's more opportunities for them. They earn a lot more money than they would in poorer countries in the Pacific.
Many of these workers are heading into Australia's aged care industry, where there is a critical shortage of workers. Aged care workers make up 4% of the 30,000 workers in the scheme. But when Pacific nurses get into Australia, Fiona McDonald says they do get better pay, but their new jobs are well below their skills level.
It's a brain drain, but it's also just a loss of skills overall. It's not that the skills from the Pacific are being utilised effectively and people are being recognised for their skills when they migrate. They're actually being recruited into a lower skilled job. The brain drain impact on the country's health systems is enormous.
Since 2023, Australia and Palm Scheme partner countries have implemented the Aged Care Expansion Program, which supports new Palm aged care workers to complete a Certificate 3 in individual support. But in Vanuatu, the health ministry is struggling to keep its workers. Beverly Bully is the administrator of the Vanuatu Association of Public Service and has witnessed the exodus of nurses.
Some health workers, they leave the health system and they work somewhere else because they are not happy with what's going on inside the administration or the management because of its weakness.
It's a similar situation in Fiji.
We are losing our very experienced and highly qualified nurses, especially our nurse unit managers and our team leaders. And they've opted to leave the country to pursue greener pastures abroad.
That's Philomena Talawandua, the General Secretary of the Fiji Nursing Association.
The concern that we have is they are qualified nursing managers. They're going to work in Australia as caregivers, and they will only work within the scope of what is there for them in the institutions that they're now working in. They will lose out on their clinical experience as registered nurses.
She says the Palm Scheme isn't supposed to take workers already employed as nurses in the Pacific to avoid a brain drain.
We have had recruitments in the country where institutions have come in to recruit our nurses. And that is something that baffles us, that between the two countries and the agreement that was reached, this had happened. And we've raised this and they're looking into this.
She says it's the team leaders, middle managers and nurse unit managers who are relied on to guide the next generation of healthcare workers who are joining the Palm Scheme.
We've had to have some of these very senior nurses rostered to doing overtime. But the situation we are facing right now is, again, we're having problems with the payment of overtime because of the budget allocation. We cannot stop them from leaving. They're leaving for reasons that they felt was best for them to leave the country, to pursue working out there in the receiving countries. They get better pay. Some of them are very pleased with the conditions that they have.
In a statement to the ABC, a spokesperson for Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade said that improving education and skills outcomes in Pacific countries is key to strengthening domestic labour markets, and that Australia's Development Assistance Program responds to partner government priorities by investing in programs to strengthen health workforce capability in Pacific Island nations. Philomena Talawandua said she would like to see the sending and receiving countries come to a compromise.
These nurses that are coming out to work in the receiving countries, they were trained by us. They were born here. They were raised here. They were given their values and the principles that they take across with them. They were nurtured, they were guided, they were upskilled clinically. We're training them at our cost and at the expense of our taxpayers of our, this country. And all we get in the end is that they leave. And we keep training our people at our cost. And if we continue with this trend, then we hate to imagine what is going to happen.
Fiona McDonald of the Australia Institute says there needs to be reforms with the Palm Scheme.
We're recommending that labour agreements that are between the Australian and New Zealand governments and the Pacific Island countries need to be much more holistic, and there needs to be some policy coherence in those labour agreements. We think they should involve involve unions, trade unions in those countries that are representing health workers in the planning and implementation of schemes so that there's a better understanding of what's going on and also thinking about migration in the context of what's happening in the health sectors.
That's Fiona McDonald, the Director of Future Work at the Australia Institute, ending that report from Lucy Cooper. It was just over a year ago that Vanuatu's capital, Port Vila, was rocked by a massive 7.3 magnitude earthquake.
Devastation in the heart of Port Vila.
Just had a major earthquake in Port Vila. God knows what it was. There's multiple buildings that have come down.
Across the city, buildings were flattened and cars crushed while people fled for safety as the ground shook. This CCTV from inside a car repair shop showing the violence of the magnitude 7.3 quake.
I was standing by my truck and it felt like my truck was jumping.
In the chaos, the death toll remains unclear. So far, one person is confirmed dead, but locals fear that figure will rise.
And the death toll did indeed rise to 14, with hundreds injured and scores of buildings flattened by the earthquake. Now, 1 year on, life is starting to return to normal. Tourists are once again visiting, but many demolished buildings are yet to be rebuilt, and some locals are frustrated at the pace of repairs. The ABC's Lily Rose Wellwell in the capital, Port Vila, filed this report on the day of the earthquake's anniversary.
Where buildings once stood, there's now open space, caps in the center of Port Vila. 1 year ago, a powerful earthquake struck the heart of Vanuatu's capital, collapsing buildings. While the rubble has been cleared, the memory still lives on. Yoshua Shing remembers the day clearly.
Standing here, well, one of my brothers died here. It's very sad to come and pass this place all the time to see and to remember that this place used to be one of the places we come every time to eat and just to come and chill. And now we don't have this anymore.
Cyril Menke is a structural engineer and vice president of the Vanuatu Engineers Association. He helped inspect damaged buildings after the earthquake.
You know, we lost 14 lives. Just one life, when you lose it, it's too much. 14 is definitely too much. So my appeal to the whole population of Vanuatu, and especially the authorities, because, you know, our government, they draft the laws, but they need to make sure they enforce it. And we must not lose lives again when it comes to earthquakes.
Port Vila's rebuilding is underway. The government has signed various construction, including an $85 million package with China. Also linked is a $24 million grant from the Asian Development Bank for redeveloping damaged roads. On the streets of Port Vila, life is returning to normal. Tourists like Australian Alison Louise Quattrell are back.
Came by boat, so on the cruise ship. I think it's really beautiful here. I love the beaches. It was really nice. We went to the Blue Lagoon area. It was very beautiful there. Yeah. Well, this is our first time coming here. We did hear about the earthquake.
Tourists are an important part of Vanuatu's economy. And the good news is government is forecasting at least one cruise ship visit per day for the next 4 months. It's welcome news, Ruth Fari, a market vendor.
After the earthquake, our sales are recovering slowly.
She's upbeat as she sells soaps, creams and beauty products under a tent where a building once stood.
The rebuild of Vanuatu is getting there, but it is slow.
Joshua Shing is a musician who performs in hotel and venues around the capital and is welcoming visitors back with open arms.
Past 6 months, tourists are coming back and the resorts are opening, hotels are opening again. And for us as musicians, I play and perform at the resorts and hotels and yes, I'm back on my feet again. I can stand. But so far, so good. So happy to have tourists back in Port Vila City. And, yes, looking forward to seeing more tourists come back.
But recovery has not been even. Large parts of the city center remain quieter than before, with many businesses still operating from temporary locations outside the city. Port Vila business owner Lopez Adams says progress feels slow.
Unfortunately, Port Vila CBD is not very lively. We need to bring back some life into the center of the city.
Mr. Adams runs a cafe and an employment incubator for young people. He says government can encourage growth by relaxing restrictions.
We're not asking for financial assistance from our government. We are asking our government to relax all the rules that makes it very difficult for business to operate, for business, new business to come in, for investors to come in.
Port Vila residents are today reflecting on the devastation of last year's earthquake, but they're also calling on the government to look to the future and plan the city's growth.
And that was the ABC's Lily Rose Wellwell with that report, marking the one-year anniversary of that deadly 7.3 magnitude earthquake that struck Port Vila last year. You're listening to Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka, taking a look back at the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. It's been a horror week on Australia's roads, with two accidents claiming the lives of three Papua New Guinea nationals. In Rockhampton, Queensland, a Meshack Valley was the victim of a single vehicle accident. In Victoria, 17-year-old Jamie Akon and 51-year-old Linda Kultia have been identified as the victims of a minivan crash, which also claimed the lives of a man and a woman from the Congo. Jamie was on a student visa living in Melbourne and had travelled to Shepparton on holidays, and Linda was a permanent resident living near the town. Simon Mack is a member of the local PNG community in Shepparton and close family friends with Linda, with both coming from the same village in the Western Highlands province. Mr. Mack told Lucy Cooper that his auntie Linda will be sorely missed.
It's traumatizing, to be honest. And we started our funeral yesterday, and it's ongoing. Everyone is coming in, you know, sharing their condolences. Sitting together, trying to sort out, work out what we can do next for the burial, and all saying that we can get some assistance if we can somewhere, and repatriate their bodies would be a great concern at the moment. But that's in talks at the moment.
Could you tell me what kind of person Linda was?
Oh, she's lovely. She's very friendly. She, you know, loves everyone. She takes part in all the community obligations, like gatherings, and, you know, we do have an association in here that, you know, needs when we have little meetings or stuff like that, she's always present. She always takes part in what the, you know, community brings across. And, she's been, she's someone we're really going to miss her.
That was Simon Mack, a close family friend of Linda Kultia. Now, police in Victoria are still investigating the crash, with the PNG government waiting on that report. Justin Kachenko is the PNG foreign minister, and he told the ABC's Lucy Cooper that the government will support the families.
It's an absolutely tragic event. We will assist wherever we can, especially for the relatives, the parents, and those that are in grief in this tragic scenario. And once we get the full details, we'll let the appropriate authorities know here in Papua New Guinea as well on assisting repatriation as best we possibly can for the two that have passed away in this car accident.
Members of the community, friends of the deceased, have said that the families wish to see their faces one last time and are calling for support for repatriation. If the families approach the PNG Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, is this something that you would be open to doing, to supporting financially to bring the bodies back to PNG?
We'll definitely look into that. We'll definitely look into that and look at what the situation is all about. You know, any Papua New Guinean abroad Not only is it one, a tragedy, and to all concerned, and especially the relatives, but also we would want to ensure that they get a proper burial with true honour and dignity that that person deserves.
And that was Papua New Guinea's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Justin Kachinko, speaking there with ABC's Lucy Cooper. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review. I'm Evan Mosuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific.